"Great Scott!" said Edmund. "We must clear this ivy away," said Peter.
"Oh, do let's leave it alone," said Susan. "We can try it in the morning. If we've got to spend the night here, I don't want an open door at my back and a great big black hole that anything might come out of, besides the draught and the damp, and it'll soon be dark."
"Susan, how can you?"
said Lucy with a reproachful glance. But both the boys were too much excited to take any notice of Susan's advice. They worked at the ivy with their hands and with Peter's pocket knife till the knife broke. After that they used Edmund's. Soon the whole place where they had been sitting was covered with ivy, and at last they had the door cleared.
"Locked, of course," said Peter.
"But the wood's all rotten," said Edmund. "We can pull it to bits in no time, and it will make extra firewood. Come on!"
It took them longer than they expected, and before they had done, the great hall had grown dusky, and the first star or two had come out overhead. Susan was not the only one who felt a slight shudder as the boys stood above the pile of splintered wood, rubbing the dirt off their hands and staring into the cold, dark opening they had made.
"Now for a torch," said Peter.
"Oh, what is the good?" said Susan. "And as Edmund said..."
"I'm not saying it now," Edmund interrupted. "I still don't understand, but we can settle that later. I suppose you're coming down, Peter?"
"We must," said Peter. "Cheer up, Susan. It's no good behaving like kids now that we are back in Narnia. You're a queen here, and anyway, no one could go to sleep with a mystery like this on their minds."
They tried to use long sticks as torches, but this was not a success. If you held them with the lighted end up, they went out, and if you held them the other way, they scorched your hand and the smoke got in your eyes. In the end, they had to use Edmund's electric torch. Luckily, it had been a birthday present less than a week ago, and the battery was almost new. He went first with the light. Then came Lucy, then Susan, and Peter brought up the rear.
"I've come to the top of the steps," said Edmund.
"Count them," said Peter.
"One, two, three,"
said Edmund, as he went cautiously down, and so up to 16.
"And this is the bottom," he shouted back.
"Then it really must be Cair Paravel," said Lucy. "There were 16.
Nothing more was said till all four were standing in a knot together at the foot of the stairway. Then Edmund flashed his torch slowly round.
"Oh!"
said all the children at once. For now all knew that it was indeed the ancient treasure chamber of Cair Paravel, where they had once reigned as kings and queens of Narnia. There was a kind of path up the middle, as it might be in a greenhouse, and along each side at intervals stood rich suits of armour, like knights guarding the treasures. In between the suits of armour and on each side of the path were shelves covered with precious things, necklaces and arm rings and finger rings and golden bowls and dishes and long tusks of ivory, brooches and coronets and chains of gold and heaps of unset stones lying piled anyhow as if they were marbles or potatoes, diamonds, rubies, carbuncles, emeralds, topazes and amethysts. Under the shelves stood great chests of oak, strengthened with iron bars and heavily padlocked. And it was bitterly cold, and so still that they could hear themselves breathing, and the treasures were so covered with dust that unless they had realised where they were, and remembered most of the things, they would hardly have known they were treasures. There was something sad and a little frightening about the place, because it all seemed so forsaken and long ago. That was why nobody said anything for at least a minute. Then, of course, they began walking about and picking things up to look at. It was like meeting very old friends. If you had been there, you would have heard them saying things like,
"Oh, look! Our coronation rings! Do you remember first wearing this? Why, this is the little brooch we all thought was lost. I say, isn't that the armour you wore in the great tournament in the Lone Islands? Do you remember the dwarf making that for me? Do you remember drinking out of that horn? Do you remember? Do you remember?"
But suddenly Edmund said,
"Look here, we mustn't waste the battery. Goodness knows how often we shall need it. Hadn't we better take what we want and get out again?
We must take the gifts, said Peter, for long ago at Christmas in Narnia, he and Susan and Lucy had been given certain presents which they valued more than their whole kingdom. Edmund had had no gift because he was not with them at the time. This was his own fault, and you can read about it in the other book. They all agreed with Peter and walked up the path to the wall at the far end of the treasure chamber, and there, sure enough, the gifts were still hanging. Lucy's was the smallest, for it was only a little bottle, but the bottle was made of diamond instead of glass, and it was still more than half full of the magical cordial which would heal almost every wound and every illness. Lucy said nothing and looked very solemn as she took her gift down from its place and slung the belt over her shoulder and once more felt the bottle at her side, where it used to hang in the old days. Susan's gift had been a bow and arrows and a horn. The bow was still there, and the ivory quiver full of well-feathered arrows, but...
"Oh, Susan," said Lucy, "where's the horn?"
"Oh, bother, bother, bother," said Susan, after she had thought for a moment. "I remember now. I took it with me the last day of all, the day we went hunting the white stag. It must have got lost when we blundered back into that other place. England, I mean."
Edmund whistled. It was indeed a shattering loss, for this was an enchanted horn, and whenever you blew it, help was certain to come to you wherever you were.
"Just the sort of thing that might have come in handy in a place like this," said Edmund.
"Never mind," said Susan. "I've still got the bow."
And she took it.
"Won't the string be perished, Sue?" said Peter.
But whether by some magic in the air of the treasure chamber or not, the bow was still in working order. Archery and swimming were the things Susan was good at. In a moment she had bent the bow, and then she gave one little pluck to the string. It twanged, a chirruping twang that vibrated through the whole room, and that one small noise brought back the old days to the children's minds more than anything that had happened yet. All the battles and hunts and feasts came rushing into their heads together. Then she unstrung the bow again and slung the quiver at her side. Next, Peter took down his gift, the shield with the great red lion on it and the royal sword. He blew and wrapped them on the floor to get off the dust. He fitted the shield on his arm and slung the sword by his side. He was afraid at first that it might be rusty and stick to the sheath, but it was not so. With one swift motion, he drew it and held it up, shining in the torchlight.
"It is my sword Rindon," he said. "With it I killed the wolf."
There was a new tone in his voice, and the others all felt that he was really Peter the High King again. Then, after a little pause, everyone remembered that they must save the battery. They climbed the stairs again and made up a good fire and lay down close together for warmth. The ground was very hard and uncomfortable, but they fell asleep in the end.